This is the October 6th, or is it 5th?
Excuse me.
5th, 2016 environmental law class, and we are venturing deeper into the Clean Air Act. Now remember, last class on Monday, we did our first overview of the statute. And the first pearl that I passed along is that there is no single integrated Clean Air Act. It's actually a collection of many statutes under the umbrella of six different titles. We walked briefly through what each title meant, mainly to give you a roadmap, because we're going to now delve into each of those titles in series. Today's is going to be on Title 1. However, before we did, Mary just scratching her. Okay, we talked about Title 2. Title 2, remember, is mobile sources. And remember the key takeaways. What are the unique features of Title 2?
Heavily technology driven.
See, he's ready. He knew I was going to do this. Okay, technology driven.
It's federal.
Federal, which means it preempts states. Anything else?
Preemption,
which is part of the federal, absolutely. And last one I'll throw onto there, the California exception. Also remember that Title II applies to fuels as well as engines. So as a result, it actually has a pretty big sweep. It covers not only just the gas that goes into your car, it covers things like biofuels and new advanced generation fuels. So very much command and control, very much if you want to take your client and argue, you have to go to EPA headquarters and sit in a certain room in EPA's building, in the Ronald Reagan building, and it's sort of old style, hardcore, traditional environmental law practice. Looking at the recorder, I'll just a very brief example without divulging confidential information to give you a feel for what it's like. We once represented a company that wanted to make a different kind of gasoline that you could use in Alaska. As it turns out, when you try and start an engine in Alaska, the spark ignition temperature for the gasoline has to be able to be effective at very low temperatures. That required you to change the nature of the gasoline itself. We had to meet with the head of the program, the EPA, and it took us 2 weeks to get ready for that, to prepare the information they wanted for it. It's very detailed and persnickety. And that's not a political commentary on my point. That's sort of, I think, the general consensus for most folks I work with in the fuels program. So before we leave fuels behind and Title II, any thoughts, questions, ideas? Folks who work for fuel companies want to tell me I've got it all wrong? I know a few in here do, but I won't call you out. All right, that means we're going to the big war horse today, Title I. Remember we talked a little bit about Title I. It is the title that sets up ambient air quality standards for what's healthy for you to breathe. It is essentially the statutory provisions that dictate when you walk out the door whether or not the air is going to have low enough levels of pollutants that you can breathe it safely every day, no matter who you are. And remember, we talked a little bit on Monday about the NAAQS process, the National Ambient Air Quality Standards process, and how you develop them. And we talked in very brief fashion about the Lead Industries Association case. And remember what the takeaway was from the Lead Industries Association case? That was a fascinating case where lead was causing hemoglobin dysfunction in kids. Essentially, I'm sorry, I'm stepping on my own answer now. If you guys want to answer, you can. Otherwise, I'll keep rolling ahead in the interest of efficiency and time.
The EPA has a really broad net to count what is harm. So in that one, it was just showing that like early markers of potential, like, the body not functioning as it should be counted as harm.
Excellent, Grace. Thank you. So essentially, it can be a subclinical effect. It can be an expression of a biological marker that isn't tied to any particular ill health effect. In this case, it was essentially the efficiency of hemoglobin to convey oxygen to the body cells. Now remember, Lead Industry Association, DC Circuit case, not Supreme Court, but still enormously persuasive case. Remember, it's a fairly old case. So we're talking about biomarkers that were really kind of beginning stage biotechnology. We're way past that now. We're talking about whether or not subclinical effects can include things such as genetic transcription effects, that the way that your DNA is actually translating RNA and proteins might be altered in a way that we don't know is linked to a particular medical condition. Is that enough to let you set an NAAQS level? Bottom line is that the standard is still, you're absolutely right, EPA has enormous discretion in deciding what is a health effect that can be a basis for an ACT standard. Right now, for example, for lead, the standard is being driven at very low levels because of IQ impacts on children. 1 or 2 points. It's enough to be deemed a significant health effect that you can have levels of lead that essentially require the phase out of lead from gasoline, the removal of lead from paint, the removal of lead effectively from commerce for any kind of commercial consumer product application. All clear so far? Because that was just the threshold. We're talking about how to set the standard. We didn't get to the big case for the day, which was, yes, a Justice Scalia opinion. I'm going to be saying that with increasing fondness and nostalgia as this time rolls on. But this was one of his big surprise cases. I can't tell you how shocked the environmental community was. And I mean that for both plaintiffs and defense counsel. When the word was around that Scalia had written the opinion, we kind of all assumed, oh boy, strap on your helmet. And he turned out right an opinion that went completely in a direction people didn't expect. So, since we have other cases to cover today, in particular, I want you to think ahead to the Duke Energy case, which we're going to finish up class today. Let me just sort of circle briefly what's going on with American trucking, unless Grace would like to jump in again because you did such a fabulous job the first time around.
No, you got it.
Okay, thank you. Bottom line is this. Cost loses. If EPA is going to set an ACT level under the Clean Air Act, Title I, the statutory language dictates that it cannot consider the cost impact of that threshold. It is solely the health-based effect. If it takes $1 trillion to set a standard that is sufficiently protective of human health, the standard must be set at that level. Now, that's driven by statutory construction arguments that Justice Scalia was focused on the text of the statute. Now, before people start scratching their heads and thinking, wow, what a wacky decision, cost does play a major role later. And we're going to talk about that role today. But for now, when we're trying to decide what is a safe level of exposure to a particular air pollutant, it is solely health, not cost. That's a huge, important, declarative statement. Because currently, the ozone level that's currently being set at a standard that is being making the resulting 70 parts per billion standard, and they were talking about 65 parts per billion, as the most expensive regulation in history because it was going to have such sweeping effects across the United States. So NAAQS entry level is solely driven by health. Does that hang together for everyone? That's our takeaway? I hate to deprive you of delving into Scalia's statutory analysis here, but I think that's sort of our first year class. This is our environmental law class. Okay. So with that in mind, let me sort of update the book. The book leaves you a little bit in the lurch, talking about the status of the ozone standard. Remember when we talked about Title I briefly on Monday, we talked about the fact that there are NAAQS standards, but there are only a few. Ozone, which also includes a embedded particular 2.5 standard. There's also lead, there's carbon monoxide, there's sulfur dioxides, there's nitrous oxides. Bottom line, though, is that for all of these, you're required to review them on 5-year cycles under the statute. What the book does is to walk you through what happened with the ozone standard up to the beginning of the Obama first administration. And essentially, trench warfare. This is the sort of thing that kept many environmental lawyers fully employed and put their children through college. The standard originally was proposed by the Bush administration at a level which EPA's own Clean Air Act Scientific Advisory Council deemed to be unprotected. They did an extraordinary step of actually an open letter to EPA saying, not good enough. That standard was effectively, the 2008 standard was promulgated, and it was essentially 75 parts per billion. Originally, we started out 120. Immediately, as soon as walking in the door, the Obama administration said they were going to re-review it and look at a lower standard. In doing so, as we came up to the first election cycle, There were rumors floating around that we were looking at levels as low as 60 parts per billion, but it could be 65 to 70. You would not believe the hullabaloo that those numbers led to at the industry side. And effectively, the technical legal term we're looking at here is punt. The Obama administration decided not to issue the rule. They postponed it. The election then took place, and I want to be fair. EPA was geared up and ready to issue the rule, and we actually talked to the administrator about it. She felt pretty strong that they had a good rule ready to propose, but for political reasons, I think I'm fair to say it didn't get to. It finally was proposed. The current standard now has been set at 70 parts per billion. That is the mark. That is the new standard. That's the one that we are now, the book doesn't get that far in the story. It actually is now final, and we're in the process now of coming up with an implementation plan to actually accomplish this goal. And that is our topic for today. How does Title I actually translate this magical NAAQS number that's deemed to be safe for human health into real world controls on the ground to actually give us clean air? So with that in mind, I'm going to pause and take a breath. Any questions so far? Okay. I will freely confess to you that some of the reading today was a little technical. I had that reaction too the first time I went through this stuff. Let me give you a little bit of encouragement. This is the most controversial portion of the Clean Air Act, except for arguably the climate change provisions, climate change regulatory provisions. So the things we're going to talk about today actually make sense if you view them in the context of history, dynamics, a dialectic between industry and environmentalist and EPA. So what I'd like to do is essentially think about what you are going to be faced with if you, or all of us, wanted to actually build a plant that's going to emit air pollutants given Title I. Does anyone need any of this? Can I get rid of it? Let me suggest to you that all of the complexities of Title I can be boiled down to some important guidepost questions. And the way you answer those first handful of questions dictate which part of the act applies to you and what it means to you. So the first question is, old or new? Is it an existing facility? Or alternatively, is it a brand new facility? Let's assume we've come up with a new NAAQS standard for a new pollutant, or we've changed the NAAQS standard. If I have an existing facility, it's already there. The bricks are in place. The piping's already there and functioning. To go back and retrofit it is an extraordinarily difficult and complex and expensive proposition many times. Alternatively, if I have a beautiful greenfield and I'm getting ready to pour the concrete, it's easy for me to integrate whatever control technologies I need to on the planning board, and the costs are much lower. That is the Faustian bargain of the Clean Air Act. It applies different standards to existing sources as opposed to new sources. That means effectively, if you have a new source, you have to comply with new source performance standards. This is a program that is essentially regulates new construction of facilities. The approach it takes is it identifies industrial sectors, cement, refining, plastics, and then if you're going to build a facility within that sector, it proposes essentially a suite of emission limits you have to attain. And usually that limit is set on what's basically a not exact, it's a control technology that is the best but still economically practical. So it is it is protective, but it's not necessarily by far the most stringent of the standards. The thing about NSPS is that it's not limited to all the NACs I had up there previously. It can include limits on things like steam. It can include limits on things like particulates that aren't 2.5 in diameter. It can include pollutants that aren't regulated in other parts of the statute. EPA has flexibility in choosing what technology attains the standard they want to choose, and they can include co-benefits if they want to. Why is that important? It means that a lot of the NSPSs now expressly include things like greenhouse gas controls, even for facilities that are not regulated under the greenhouse gas rules. If you build a new facility and you have the pollutants that you're controlling, greenhouse gases get folded into that control technology. If you don't, at that point you get under the Title I SIP process for, I've got these reversed, I'm sorry. This is new, this is old, existing. And we're going to talk about this in greater detail right now. The key thing is that this is your first question. You have totally different standards that apply to you if you're new as opposed to an existing facility. The second question is, where are you at? For most of the NACs we're talking about, if I emit them, they largely stay in place. Historically, if you look at 1970, 1977, even 1990, when we passed the Clean Air Act and amended it, most pollutants were things like smog, things like particulates, things that, like carbon monoxide, where as people emitted them, they tended to stay around the urban area. So air pollution is viewed as largely an urban problem. What does that mean? It means that certain parts of the country have air that already meets the national ambient air quality standards. So let's just call it clean. And then you have other parts where, bless you, where the air doesn't, where you don't meet the national ambient air quality standard. It's a little complicated how you do that under the regulations, but basically you're required to monitor the air and you take the fourth highest reading over a period averaged over 2 years or more. Bottom line is that, let's just call it dirty, which is an unfair term, but just for our purposes for today. It means you're not attaining the national ambient air quality standard. Once again, that dictates which program you're under. If your air is clean, the idea is to keep it clean. Imagine if we had a national ambient air quality standard and the air met that standard, and so as a result, state and EPA said, go forth and build. The air's fine. You can pollute all you want to because we're meeting the standard. Well, essentially, you have a pollution rush where essentially you are permitted to pollute down to the level where the NAAQS kicks in, and then you have to start protecting it. Essentially, you're writing off clean air. Based on a court decision that later got incorporated into the Clean Air Act, the idea is to create a program called Prevention of Significant Deterioration, PSD. And it is designed to essentially keep air clean that is clean. It's not an absolute, obviously, cap. It's not a limit. You can still add pollutants to clean air. But how much you emit is driven by the PSD program and the permits you have to get under. By contrast, if the air is not an attainment, you have to get what's called a non-attainment new source review permit. Oftentimes just called NNSR. These are different beasts. The new source, I'll just call them NNSR permits, are designed not only to keep the air from getting dirtier, they're actually designed to get it cleaner, to actually allow emissions in a way that the air slowly begins to improve to the point where you start meeting the NAAQS standard. So as a result, the technologies differ that you have to attain. Allie?
Sorry, what does NNSR, will you repeat what it stands for?
Sure. I want to be fair. Oftentimes, people just call it new source review, NSR permits. The problem is you get terribly confused because if you look at the statute, they actually call all these programs new source review, and people get a mix of all time. So if you talk to most practitioners, they'll call it non-attainment new source review. And that's the beast we're talking about now. What does this all mean? It means that if we are going out to build our new facility in the middle of the green fields, we've got to get a PSD permit. And the PSD permit uses a totally different intellectual architecture in deciding how much you're going to get to permit. What you do is you have to essentially do a computer modeling of the air in that area and then determine increments of pollution that you can emit that will not impair that air quality. So you do the increment modeling, and then once you've done that, you work with the state or EPA, depending where you're at, and essentially then choose the best available control technology that lets you attain that standard. And we could probably spend a whole month just talking about how the agencies figure out what BACT is. Fortunately, we're all spared that for this class. I'll simply say that BACT is essentially a balancing act where the agency picks a technology that's good, but at the same time is still economically achievable. Cost does play a role in selecting BACT. NSR is different. NSR essentially says that you have to not only control your emissions, you have to take existing emissions off the table so that the air slowly improves until it actually reaches attainment. So effectively then, you have to use what are called offsets. We'll talk about those in just a minute. Offsets basically are the idea that for every ton of pollution you want to emit, you've got to find 1.1 tons someplace else, or 1.3 or 1.5, depending on how much out of attainment your air is, and get them off the table too. So eventually, with your new facility, even with adding pollution, the total amount of pollution in the air is going down. The other is the technology you have to use, and HOEE is the last acronym for a while, lowest achievable emission rate. This is the bulldog. This is the one that strikes fear into the heart of industrial planners throughout the Houston region. LAIR is an extraordinarily stringent standard where you have to choose the technology that has the lowest emission rate, and economics plays a much smaller role in choosing that as opposed to BACT. If you've got a non-attainment NSR permit with a LAIR determination, buckle up. The agency is usually going to be very insistent on having a standard that's going to be state-of-the-art or close to it. Does that make sense for everyone so far? So those are the big questions. Hopefully that helps, gives you a framework for the description of the book, which gets a little bit into the weeds. So I really, this is not my usual kind of question as we keep driving by. I want to stop and pause for a minute. Does this really hang together for you? Because this is sort of the kernel in the middle of the operating system for the Clean Air Act. And we can get into more details about what is a major modification, what's a new source, and talk about how the standards get implemented. But if you don't get this, you're pretty much cooked. And I'll be honest with you, I don't see how I could even write a final exam in this class without covering some of this. So I want to make sure it feels comfortable to you. So any questions about it or from the readings in this portion of the chapter?
That LAIR, is that, you said that's the lowest achievable emission rate?
That's right.
And they have to use the state of the tech or state of the art technology?
Essentially, yes.
Essentially, or close to it?
Pretty close, yeah. Okay. And you're not allowed to, you don't have to insist on a LAIR that is a technology that is not in use at all. Like, I had one where we had a shipyard where they were talking about how to remove paint without creating emissions. Usually you use like a stripper. We had a vendor come in saying they wanted to use a laser removal system, which was very cool, but it was like three orders of magnitude more expensive and never been used anywhere else. And the agency said, that's not LAIR. But usually it has to be pretty extreme for you not to have this LAIR.
What is the
BACT? Best Available Control Technology. Okay, so if I were to give you a hypo where you were being asked to build a plant somewhere in the grassy plains of Southeast Texas, you guys would at least know which questions to start asking. Or what air permits might apply. And we'll elaborate on it just to make sure you have the basic work here. Okay? And what I might do, if you guys would like, is I can actually draft up a hypo and just hand out at the beginning of next class so you guys can practice on chewing on it. All right? Okay. Let the record reflect. Everyone said yes, so I can create extra work for the class now. See, Art, you should have objected when you had the chance. Okay, so that's the framework. Now be evil with me. Assume that you want to find a way to have your facility built and not trigger NSPS, or not trigger some of the more stringent provisions here. Imagine you have an existing facility perking along, and you want to essentially add a new product line to it. Option one is go about a mile away and build a new facility. What happens then? NSPS bites you first. And depending where you're at, you may then have a PSD or NSR new permit you have to get. And you have to go through the entire top-down calculation on what's back, or figure out what layer is, and find the offsets. By the way, we'll talk about this later in the class, but offsets could be tens of thousands of dollars a ton, sometimes more particular pollutants. There are people who make a very comfortable living in Houston basically being pollution bankers who buy and sell these credits. So with that in mind, suppose instead you build it next door on the same piece of land. New facility? Co-located facility? We're getting to that, I promise, in just a second. That's one possibility. Whether or not it's in the same property line, is this all considered to be one source? In which case, if I reduce emissions here, I can create space for me to add emissions here. And then I don't trigger whatever ton threshold there is for me to get one of these permits. So if I could, let me give you, these are not acronyms, so I can do this now. Bubbling, netting, and offsets. These three terms get used all the time in different ways. I don't mean to tell you that you will look like an idiot at a cocktail party if you use one the wrong way, because people use them fairly loosely. But the bottom line is this. Bubbling was sort of the first iteration of this concept, where EPA said, imagine you have a bubble of the whole facility. If I reduce emissions here, I can add emissions there. And that was sufficient to dictate that you could comply with your permit using bubbling. Netting is an extension of bubbling. The idea is, I do a netting calculation to see whether or not I even have a major source that would trigger this framework. Bubbling is a way of attaining compliance, meeting your permit limit. Netting means you don't need a permit. So as you can imagine, netting becomes a very big deal. Netting can be done with a physical change to your facility. You can also do netting by essentially having a federally enforceable restriction on your emissions. Essentially, it's called a synthetic miner. You essentially choke the ability of your facility to run at full throttle so that it doesn't get emissions above a certain threshold. Offsets are slightly different. Usually, offsets mean you go outside the boundary of your facility. You're buying someone else's emissions and using them to offset yours. Bless you. Hell, you're still allergic to something. I should warn you, I actually had someone tell me, actually one of our professors has come down with a flu, so it's the first flu case I've heard. Okay. For what it's worth, it sounds pretty bad. She actually missed a class on Monday. Offsets essentially mean I can go across the street or down the way or anywhere in the same airshed, basically, and buy 2 tons that I need to have to be able to produce my 1 ton under non-attainment NSR. Offsets, that's its sort of narrower, specific use to the Clean Air Act. It's also used more generally to apply that same concept of just getting someone else's emissions and buying them to take them off the air or the market so that you can emit what you want to. So as a result, offsets are enormously important as tradable credits for greenhouse gases, which we'll come to in our next class of the week.
Is that similar to mitigation banking or wetlands?
Very close. Would you like to tell the class about mitigation? It's sort of a brief review of our discussion in class a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, so if you're going to destroy a wetland, you can buy a piece of another area of land, and they'll build a wetland there. Mm-hmm.
So the difference is, the concept is exactly the same, you're right, but there's some important fundamental differences.
That sentence was totally contradictory. It comes down to this. A wetlands mitigation bank, we're entrepreneurs. We go out and create a wetland, or we go out, in some cases you preserve a wetland to make it better, but usually you're making something new. And then at that point, it's like pantry, it's on the shelf. You can sell it to someone who wants to destroy a wetland somewhere else in the same watershed. In theory, you make 2 or 3 or 5, I've seen as high as 15-to-1 offsets of wetlands, where 1 acre destroyed here creates basically 15 acres there. Offsets are a little different in that usually, and I think it's fair to say this, usually people are not creating credits this way. These offsets are because someone has shut down a facility and is no longer active. So they essentially have these inactive credits sitting there that they can sell. But you're not creating a bank that way. Two important limitations on that, what I'm saying, I want to overstate it. One, some companies do go out and prospect. That they've discovered that they really, really need these offsets to be able to build a new facility. They'll actually survey everyone else around and find someone who's really old and efficient and who could be bought out cheaply, and they'll just say, hey, we'll pay you $1 million to shut down. And the person says, well, I need to work on my golf handicap. That sounds great. That's fairly rare, but it can happen. The other, and this is the one that for those of you who are interested in practicing environmental law here in Houston and other major cities, you actually have what are called AERCOs, Air Emission Reduction Corporations. That what we have in here is actually set up by the local Harris County Area Council. It's a governmental organization where essentially they keep track of people who shut down and then essentially consolidate them so that they can be a clearinghouse of information for where you can actually try and create these offsets. And sometimes they even take steps to try and maintain them. So they don't go out and make them happen, but they find out where they're popping up and then integrate them into a common place you can go one-stop shop. Okay? That was a very long answer to a very good question. Thank you. Any others? Okay. So, extending this, moving past Chevron, let's be truly evil. But I use evil as an affectionate, non-pejorative term. Instead of building one next door, I tear down this guy. In the same footprint, same style, I rebuild. You drive by, it looks exactly the same, it just doesn't have quite as much mold in the bricks. Is that a new facility?
Yes.
Why?
It's literally the definition of new. You removed and created a new thing.
Okay.
You didn't like move into the old facility. You tore it down and created a new facility.
Okay, so I think Arts has grabbed onto, I think, the theoretical extreme of what I'm pointing out here. All right. I'll tell you, if you're ever advising engineers, by the way, are there engineers in the classroom?
A lot downstairs.
A lot downstairs?
There have some tests. There's a bunch of engineering students in the class.
Okay. Well, one thing you'll find when you're counseling environmental issues, a lot of times you're dealing with engineers, and their immediate reaction is, okay, but what if we did this? So imagine we leave the walls up. We leave the utilities in place. We leave everything in place. We just change out a machine inside, maybe add a machine here. New facility? Important question in terms of whether or not you can build. Makes sense? I'm kind of curious, any preliminary thoughts on how you draw that line? Because if we, I'm sorry, Allie, go ahead. Well, that's what Congress decided. I'm asking intellectually, can you think of just offhand, if you had a blank piece of paper, anything that comes to mind as to what's a good dividing mark? Is there one?
Percentage of material?
In what way?
So if you take the entire material used to create the facility and you get rid of or change out over 50%, then it becomes a new facility?
So 50% is the magic number? Okay. So 100% Arts rule. You can use that in the final if you'd like. That's a new source. 0%. Everyone here agrees that's not a new facility. Okay. And by the way, that's entirely plausible. If I have this facility and I'm running it on weekdays, and then I add a weekend production schedule, my emissions have gone up at least 20%. Does that make it a new facility effectively for air pollution purposes? EPA has said no. Statute expressly says operational hours are not sufficient to make a source a new source for new source review purposes. Boy, that sentence was terrible. So why 50%? I mean, I agree with you. Intuition says, but.
Yeah, I just popped out of my head. Mm-hmm. But you could draw a parallel to historic buildings and preservation, and whether you're judging whether it retains integrity, and there's aspects of integrity you look at. It's pretty subjective call, though. You just have to be followed by.
I hadn't thought about that. And that's, with your background, I should have thought of that. That's a great analogy.
That doesn't come down to percentages.
Yeah. Zero. And I guess here's, I'll be honest with you. I struggle with this. We had a debate about this in the 1990s. What's the fair number? If you say it's 50%, a lot of folks felt that basically was carte blanche for people to rebuild the most important parts of their facilities and increase emissions substantially. If you said 10%, light bulb switching projects theoretically could trigger the new source review. So we went back and forth and back and forth, and eventually 20% emerged as one number. And routine maintenance and repair ruled up making, which was then struck down by the court. I leave that for what you will. So point being is that, think about this as, I mentioned the dialectic at the start of class, it's a push me, pull me. It's a back and forth that continues when almost every one of these environmental programs, where you can come up with a fairly clear principle with some great operational ideas to implement it, but putting it into place in the ground, you have to account for the fact that people are continuously thinking about creative ways so they can do what they need to do without triggering onerous requirements. This is perfectly appropriate. But it means that the law has to catch up and go back and forth in a continual Red Queen's race. So here, for the question is essentially, what is a modification? Quote unquote. And now we're getting towards the Duke Energy case. Before we start talking about Duke, the book gives a little flavor of it, but about 8 to 10 years ago, maybe even a little bit more recently, this was the issue in environmental law. Most of our coal-fired power plants tend to have been built somewhere, they can range anywhere from 40 to 60 years old. Coal-fired power plants are huge beasts that rely on some fairly straightforward engineering, which is, I'm skidding over some very interesting technological dimensions there, but the bottom line is you burn it in giant boilers to convert water to steam to create energy. So the people who run coal-fired energy utilities are very smart people, and they've clearly caught on to the issue here, what's a modification. And the last thing they wanted to do was effectively take an old coal-fired power plant and then effectively and unwittingly create a new one by updating it, by retrofitting it, by essentially taking a 50-year-old boiler and replacing it with a new next-generation boiler. So as a result, they all, and again, not as part of a concerted activity, but just all kind of reached the same conclusion, they all decided that if they were going to go through and leave the building standing and go through and take out boilers and replace them with boilers, that was routine maintenance and repair or replacement, which is the terminology in the regulation. If you can show that it's routine maintenance, just like swapping a light bulb, boom, you haven't triggered new source review. You haven't triggered PSD. Now I'm pausing. How many of you find that a persuasive argument so far? Because I really am trying to be fair to both sides. No one's persuaded by that? All right, my former partners would be very disappointed in me for not making the case better. I will say that this is not an outlier fringe position. the vast overwhelming majority of the coal-fired utilities took this position. And what it meant was that these projects were deemed to be routine replacement, even if they were enormous in scale, took months to accomplish, and were multi-million dollar projects. Picture a boiler. I'm not talking like the boiler in your basement. Some of these boilers are anywhere from 6 to 8 stories tall. Some of them are so big that the only way to replace them was to knock a hole in the wall of the building and build a rail line into the building to convey it out. There's no other way to get it out. As a result, when EPA looked around and suddenly realized that they had gotten no permit applications for new coal-fired power plants in nearly 40 years, some people started saying, what's going on? And that resulted in enforcement initiatives. Now, quick question before we get to Duke Energy then. Who would like to be the industry representative for today's discussion? It's a chance to stretch your intellectual muscles. You don't have to believe it. Just be able to advocate for it. No one? Okay, who wants to be the environmentalist? All right, now I know it's not a question of philosophical orientation.
I'll be the industry representative.
Thank you so much. Who wants to be his dyed-in-the-wool, fight-to-the-death opponent? No? All right. Let's see. Usual principle here. Who is the farthest person from you by space? Usually that means poor Carl in the very back row, but instead, and Graham, I picked on you already. Allie, you're sneezing. Brad, would you be willing to take the ball for us today?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Without going into great detail, but pretend I'm someone who's in a public hearing. I'm a citizen nearby. I'm concerned. You are representing a coal industry utility that has done this boiler replacement project. And I say, I don't understand. Why aren't you building a new facility? What is it about this that would make it something routine maintenance and repair from the perspective that you would argue?
Well, I mean, first thing I'd say, other people in the industry are doing the same thing.
Okay, in what way?
People, maybe the same industry, same coal-fired power plants are replacing their boilers in other areas, or I guess nearby, or maybe across the country. And so if you don't, you'll lose competitiveness. And so by doing so, it's kind of industry standard.
So it's routine but yeah. For the industry.
For the industry.
Not for your facility.
Right.
Okay. Anything else?
Let's see. On how it could be.
Be prepared, Brad. You have to shoot holes in all of these.
On why it's routine. I don't know. Boilers go out. Get outdated. I mean.
You're welcome to also take a look at anything else in the acronym as well. Remember, it's routine maintenance, repair, and replacement.
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm just replacing it.
So.
It falls under that exemption.
So it has to be exactly the same boiler. Suppose it's a different type of metal. Suppose it's slightly more efficient.
Yeah, no, it could be something new. I mean, it says replacement, but it doesn't mean that you have to, does that technically mean that it has to be the exact same?
Well, what's the interest of your client to answer?
Well, no, it could be something better.
There you go. See, you're on the first steps now. All right, anything else? Because I want y'all to realize we're effectively recreating the arguments of Duke here without even having to look at the case.
I guess, I mean, you could also look at the facility as a whole, like it's a unit, instead of it seeing it as separate parts. So by merely replacing a part of it, it's like, I guess, maintenance. It's not, I mean, if you look at it as a facility as a whole, you know what I mean? So in that instance, it could fall under the routine maintenance.
So like it's less than the 50%?
Yeah, okay. If you look at it as a whole, it's, you know, I guess a boiler would be 5%, whatever.
Yeah. It may be a multi-million dollar, enormously huge and complicated 5%, but it's 5%. Okay. Anything else you throw into it there? Because you've made some very key arguments.
I guess that's it.
Allie?
I was gonna say, I think just also.
Your co-counsel wants to speak.
I think also there's kind of a public policy argument is that especially if you replace something with better technology or more efficient technology that might even be reducing emissions, why would you want to penalize a company and make them go through a tedious application for a new permit?
Wow, that was I was almost getting deja vu hearing that. Very good, exactly. I mean, essentially you're discouraging investment in more efficient technologies that ultimately reduce pollution, which gets a little bit uncomfortably close as to why we have this program in the first place. But you're right. To a certain extent, we're perpetuating 60-year-old boilers if we don't allow this. Okay? Is anyone starting to get a little more persuaded from the arguments from previously? Because, Brad, now it's your job to sway the jury the other way.
I'd say, if you're replacing a part or something like that on a car, you don't replace the entire car. You replace the part. So if you take out the 6-story to 8-story tall boiler and put a new one in there, that's almost like buying a new car. It's not buying a new part for the car. It's getting a whole new item.
So it matters if it's the engine as opposed to the seat cover.
Right.
It's the function that matters.
Well, I'd say if it's the technology is basically changing, if you get an updated car, it's got all this new technology on it. Same with the boiler. If you're getting a new boiler because it's going to be technology driven, it's going to be more efficient, it's going to be better standard for the coal factory, then that's something new. That's not routinely fixing the boiler. Mm-hmm. You're creating a whole new item.
Okay. So that's one. Anything else you throw out there? How do you respond? That responds to the 5%. It's just it's a piece, but it's not a big piece argument. What about the fact that it's routine? Everybody does it.
I think the fact that everybody doesn't make it okay to, all of a sudden be like, well, everybody does it, so I can do it. I just don't think that's a good argument in general for someone to have.
So the argument all of our mothers made, if all your friends did it, you should do it too?
Yeah.
If all the lemmings were off a cliff, you'd go along.
The bridge, so I jump off the bridge too. Yeah. I don't think it's a good argument. Maybe everybody should be re-reviewed then at that point.
Okay. It has a certain moral suasion to it. If we were in a jury posture for enforcement, maybe that would have a little bit of weight. Mark?
I just want to add real quick, his argument was not that just because everyone was doing it, is it's done to be economically competitive.
That's true.
And so it's not just jumping off the bridge just because all your buddies are. It's producing at a level, otherwise you'll be phased out of the market.
Absolutely true. And could I take a small editorial moment?
Sure.
You are absolutely accurately capturing a very important point. In the world of environmental law, you have to employ that argument with great caution, because the one thing the agency truly hates is being told that someone had to do it because they needed to be economically competitive and they couldn't make money unless they violated the standard. That's not only a gateway to enforcement, sometimes it's a gateway to criminal enforcement. But you're absolutely right, and certainly it goes to Ali's point previously about why would you want to discourage more innovation, more efficient technologies? If you don't, not only are you going to lose opportunities, you're going to go out of business. Okay. But circling back, Brad, routine. Anything else you would throw out on that? Besides the fact that everyone does it, doesn't make it right.
Well, like you were saying earlier, I guess, if you have to get all these rails in and build all this stuff just to get the machine out and replace it, I don't think that's considered routine if you have to build all of this stuff just to replace one boiler.
So even if everyone does it,
I'd say it depends on, if you're taking out walls of your facility to try to remove things and to basically put the facility back up, you're going out of your way to make the facility look the exact same, that almost shows that it's not routine, because routine things wouldn't require you to take down walls.
Mm-hmm. So could I take it and twist it a little bit?
Sure.
And correct me if I'm miscapturing your spirit. It's not that it's the scale of it. You could have fairly routine activities that are huge in scale. Switching out nuclear fuel rods, for example. It has to happen, but no one thinks that's going to be like a new reconstruction of the nuclear facility. It's more a question of what's routine for this facility as opposed to what's routine for the industry.
Right.
So we're looking at from the fence line. It sure as hell is not routine. If I'm going to be building a rail line, knocking down the walls, and hauling out a 500-ton, 6-story tall tank, and replacing it with a brand new stainless steel tank.
So. I'm going to go against my position just for a second. But I was thinking a good way for you to bypass this NSPS triggering is by, if you do it, if you look at it from a temporal perspective, if you do it bit by bit by bit over a long period of time, then in essence, given a period of say 30 years, something like that, you've got a new facility without having to update any of your requirements. So that could be a good argument to make from an environmental standpoint, that this just merely a way to sidestep triggering that.
Absolutely, and I have to be careful what I say. That approach is not unheard of. I've heard it called construction creep.
Yeah.
The idea is that instead of doing one big project, you do 10% 1 year, 10% the next year, 10% for the following year, and by the end, you've stitched together a brand new facility, but you've done it with chunks that all fall under minor source permits or escape permit thresholds. All I'll say is the agency is aware of that tactic, and that if you have a series of constructions that are clearly part of an integrated arc of a single project, that they will deem that to be initiation of a major construction project, even if you do it in stages. But I would not be, I would be lying to you if I told you that was a bright line, and that there, that that approach gets litigated fairly often. And I don't mean to imply that it's an there's evasion going on. I think you've raised a point which actually makes sense, where a lot of times you don't know if you're going to need this. You might build, for example, a four-train production facility, train being like a line of production. Mm-hmm. So like one line's making polypropylene, but it's easy to scale it up and have two, three, and four. You may hold off on building two, three, and four until you know you've got an economic market for the one you've built. And then lo and behold, you end up effectively doing construction creep. The agency has to figure out how to deal with that. Usually what they'll say is that if you're laying the groundwork for a fully integrated facility, you have to look at what's called potential to amend, not actual emissions. And you have to look at the integrated project, not just the piece that you're putting in place. But it's hard. Now, you've raised a very good point. All right, so Brad, have I done justice to you? Is there anything else you want to add to this point?
That's pretty much all I had.
Okay.
All I thought of.
Now let me pick up Allie's point and extend it a little bit further for both of you. The odds are pretty high that if I'm swapping out a 60-year-old tank that's corroded and filled with carbon and I replace it with a brand spanking new shiny stainless steel tank, it's going to run better, which means that the rate of pollutants I'm emitting per hour will go down. Is that relevant at all to determine whether or not this is replacement or a new project? Effectively, my facility is emitting less pollution, isn't it?
I mean, I think that still probably goes to replacement, just to go against my argument for a little bit, that like that almost should be something positive for environmentalists to look at, to be like, well, the emissions and everything's going down, so why discourage something like that?
Okay, and I like the way everyone's switching sides here. It's this true law school experience. You're equipping yourselves to argue any point at any time. I won't say any words about moral flexibility, but...
What is your metrics? Are you doing it by the day, by the hour, by the month, by the year? Mm-hmm. So the thought is that if you're able to produce three times more coal in a year, then you are, even if you have less emissions per whatever amount of coal, you're still producing way more, so you still have more emissions, even if the hourly emission rate goes down or the daily emission rate goes down, which is what's kind of bizarre about it.
Mm-hmm.
So and I mean, I think it's just about like who gets to set what the metric is, and the EPA is like, you get different.
Exactly. And now it sounds like we are segueing over to Duke Energy at this point. I almost called it Duke Coal, which they would not appreciate. You're absolutely correct. And this is, by the way, not a weird counter-factual hypothetical. Most of the facilities were in a position where, because of their increased efficiency of operation by having a new unit, they had a lower rate of emissions by the hour, but they emitted more pollution by running it longer and more severely. So this definitional question, which sounds like the set of stuff that philosophy majors would spend late night beer and pizza over, actually has real world multi-million dollar, multi-billion dollar implications. So which brings us to our case, and I think this is our only opinion by Justice Souter for the entire semester, the Duke Energy case. So taking Brad, Allie, take everyone who's been answering so far off the table, who would like to discuss the Duke Energy case? Which, by the way, I think, did we talk about this in statutory interpretation as well? Sometimes it pops up in the class. It's a classic statutory interpretation case, too. So I was hoping it'd be a twofer for you. Okay. All right, I'm going to look for someone who hasn't had a chance to speak in a while. Rebecca, you
had to... I saw it like 4 minutes ago.
Oh, okay. It's just you have to realize I don't see a lot of times because Patrick is sitting right in front of you, so I have your basically your left ear, I think, for most of the class.
Being 5'2" doesn't really
help.
So, do you want just the facts or the weird procedural stuff that brought it up?
You know the law professor answer is both, but you can choose what you'd like to start with. Just imagine, I know it's it's incredible to imagine, but there's a possibility that some people in this class have not read the case. So explain it to them in a way so that they can participate in our conversation to follow. So you can structure however you like.
Cocktail parties.
Sadly enough, it does happen. Being married to an environmental lawyer, we invite environmental lawyers, we have conversations like this, but carry on.
Not to disparage those kinds of cocktail parties. So initially, the U.S. had appealed from a part of a lower ruling holding that as a matter of law, the EPA had to interpret increased emissions for the purpose of NSRs, meaning increases to hourly emissions rates. The circuit court affirmed, and although the U.S. didn't seek certiorari, environmental defense was an intervener in the case and did appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So even
though, by the way, look at the date of the case. It might explain a little bit on that.
Yeah, and this came out in 2007.
So who was president then?
G-Dub,
thank you. You can imagine how well it went over when the Department of Justice basically said, oh, we don't want to appeal that ruling. So yeah, keep going.
So then, in the actual case, I'm pulling up mine. So decades earlier in the 70s, Congress had added air pollution control schemes to the Clean Air Act, which was PSDs and NSPS.
Mm-hmm.
And environmental EPA regulations interpreted modification one way for NSPS but differently for PSD. For NSPS regulations, my thing is all screwed up. So PSD regulations required a permit for modification only when it was a major one and only when it would increase actual annual emissions for pollutants above an average for prior years.
Okay.
So
as opposed to NSPS, what was?
For NSPS, the regulations required a source to use best available pollution limiting technologies.
Okay, which usually means it's measured how? So, if I have an NSPS limit, is it going? How are they going to measure whether or not my technology is hitting the mark it's supposed to?
It's for whatever new technologies are available. So it changes more, I guess, as new technologies come out.
Pretty close. If I'm putting in new technology, usually EPA selected that new technology based on how it performs. So if you're in a laboratory, how are you going to measure whether or not your particular device is actually controlling pollution as you're running it?
I mean, through testing it.
Well, close. I mean, what's the metric? What would you use? Would you, like, capture the pollution and weigh it? Or would you sort of measure how much is coming out in a rate per hour? Or would you sort of look at input-output? How would you do it?
Probably on annual emissions.
Isn't that what PSD is?
That's where I was kind of confused.
Okay. Fair point. Here's sort of the dichotomy, the choice. It's really NSPS, the original rules that were then added to the PSD program later by Congress, that defined it as hourly rate of emission. Now, I know some of you are thinking, why in God's name would anyone care? Why does that make any sense? Why would you have different ones? And the answer is, think about where these spring from. If I have a new technology, I've selected that new technology based on the way it performs in usual laboratory settings. The way you measure that is, what's your rate per hour? What's it actually putting out when you turn the crank? So as a result, NSPS, quite logically, focuses on the performance on an ongoing basis of a technology and choosing the best one. They don't total up the number of tons at the end of the year. They don't care. They're choosing a technology, not an attainment result, not a certain quality of air. PSD is different. Remember, PSD is all about keeping the air clean or cleaning up the air that's already dirty. So what we care about there is, what's the gunk in the air? What's coming out? And that's actual emissions. And that's something you measure on a basis, usually annually. So while it sounds like an abstract distinction, this tons per year versus hourly rate actually reflects a philosophical fundamental difference between the two programs. Now, and Rebecca, I hear the noise increasing in the hallway. I suspect our time is drawing to a close, so I may take a little bit. I'm going to ask you to be my fact checker, like we're having the presidential debate. You can have like a little scroll at the bottom telling me where I've gotten things wrong, so please interrupt me as we go. And I'm quite serious. I do screw up routinely. Given this distinction, EPA kind of had a tough situation because the statute uses the same word in both programs. Now, hearkening back to those of you who suffered through statutory interpretation first year, remember, what is the presumption when a statute uses the same word in different portions of the same act?
Full act, full act, same meaning.
Same meaning. Even Courtney, who never had me for first year, is knowing that. So, we're running in head first into a presumption that words are used consistently. That if Congress chose a word in one portion of the statute, they meant the same thing in the other part of the statute. And here it's even worse because the language in the statute expressly refers to the prior NSPS definition, incorporates it by reference. So I'll pause for a minute and let that sink in. How does EPA wiggle out of that one? Essentially, EPA has said, by regulation, given the context of the philosophical difference between these two programs, we're going to choose to define actual emissions as the benchmark for PSD purposes. Now, here we get to Justice Souter's argument. And Justice Souter, I can't remember if, I think this was unanimous. I don't think Scalia dissented in this opinion. Essentially said, yeah, agencies have the discretion to interpret the same word in the same statute differently, to give it a different meaning. And it's allowed to do so as long as if you view the rest of the statute in context, that it attains the goals of the statute. There was no congressional legislative history here saying that they meant hourly versus actual. There is no specific direction in the statute itself saying one meant one and the other meant something different. EPA read it into the structure of the act. Having done so, the Supreme Court said that is totally within the realm of reasonable interpretation by the agency, given the complexity of the statute and its goals. So what does that mean? It means that if I tell you that I have a major source and it's based on my emissions, that doesn't answer the question. You've got to have an idea of what the program you're talking about is and what its goal is. All right, circling back, that's the interesting legal decision. What does it mean practically? What it means ultimately is that when you're determining whether something is a major source, for PSD and for NSR purposes, it's tons per year. Usually, it's potential to emit. It's not what you actually emit for purposes of getting that permit for a facility. They want to look at what happens if you turn up the crank all the way to the full nameplate capacity. Unless you have a federally enforceable limit that throttles it down. Remember, we talked about that previously. So for NSPS, it's all about how efficient you are. It's whether you have a Prius instead of a Cadillac. It's the hour per rate that determines whether or not you've got a major source that then determines whether or not what type of technology you have to apply. And here I'm pausing. Hanging together so far for everyone? Because what I'd like to do is retreat. I'm going to be the coward today. Normally I would say, let's do a mad dash, summarize everything real quickly. What I'd like to do is let this settle in, and then on Monday, let's tie all this together about how this actually means the permit system works if you want to do a facility in the Houston area. I just use Houston because I know it. I'd like to then talk about markets, since that's also part of our reading for today, and it actually shapes some of our discussion here. And it actually has some interesting applications that are happening in the front pages of the paper right now. And then we'll then move on and talk about major air toxics and also some acid rain and ozone transport issues. And believe it or not, next week by Wednesday, we'll be done with the Clean Air Act. And I should say,
and this is an editorial comment, please do not think that I'm giving you the full picture. We actually have someone who teaches a full semester of Clean Air Act here. It is an enormously complex, rich, and rewarding area of law. I had lunch with someone who is a new attorney who just graduated from here, and basically our theme was, if you want to build an environmental practice, clean air is the place to start. So if you're interested in it, please dig deeper. This is a fascinating area, but we're just getting sort of the basics right now. All right, last chance. Any other questions, thoughts, ideas, recommendations on puppies? All right. Okay, then with that, have a great weekend. I'll see everyone on Monday. Enjoy the, quote, debate, close quote.